heard my friend cry, and he sank to his knees, coughing blood as he screamed for his mother. And I fell by his side, and that's how we died, clinging like kids to each other. And I lay in the mud and the guts and the blood, and I wept as his body grew colder. And I called for my mother, and she never came, though it wasn't my fault, and I wasn't to blame. The day not half over, and 10,000 slain. And now there's nobody remembers our names. And that's how it is for us all.
Everybody wants some. I want some too. Guys. 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 It's not that kind of some. It's the Battle of the Somme. It's a famous World War I conflict. It's actually kind of ugly and sad.
Oh, wow, man.
I know. It was a lot for me to handle, too.
Wait a second, man.
What?
Dedicate one to the ladies.
No, no. You can't dedicate this one to the ladies, Dave. There were no ladies at the Somme, and this isn't really a sexy topic. In fact, I think it would be really not cool to try to make it that.
Oh my God!
I'm sorry, I know that's like your thing, but it's just, it's not gonna work for this episode. Dude, are you okay? You kind of sound like you're having a meltdown over there, man. Listen, don't freak out on me here. It's not the end of the world.
Ow, might as well jump.
Hey, don't even talk like that. It's one episode. I'll find a place to work you in eventually, okay? But when you say you're thinking about jumping, I have to take that seriously as a threat of self-harm.
Jump!
Hey, knock it off, guys. I can hear you back there. This isn't a joke. Now, Dave, I don't think you really mean that, do you?
See, a gun is real easy.
Okay, just stop it. Just stop it right now. Or I will call the police, and I will have them put you under 24-hour watch.
Oh my God!
But you think I won't? I am dead serious. And what are you gonna do then, huh? What are you gonna do when I call the police to come get you?
Reach down between my legs and...
What the fuck?
Ease the seat back.
Oh, I thought... Sorry, I thought you were being gross.
I don't feel tardy.
Well, you are. And that's why I can't feature you on an episode about World War I. It's just not really a Van Halen kind of a topic. You know what I mean?
Oh, wow, man.
I know. I'm sure it's disappointing, but I take the subject matter very seriously most of the time. And for this episode, we just need a different kind of a voice than you can provide.
Hello, babe.
Well, you get the fuck out of here. And take the rest of the band with you, yeah, dead or alive. Go, I gotta start. Sorry about that. And don't say anything, but I'm probably not gonna put them into an episode. Not because I don't have the room or anything like that. I just hate Van Halen. And speaking of, has a music podcaster ever had to make a transition to World War I from Van Halen? Is this hell of my own making unique to me exclusively? All right, well, fuck it. Let's make history. And speaking of fair warning, you know who wasn't given fair warning? Oh my gosh, this is going great right now. The British troops charging into German machine gun fire at the Somme. Wow. I feel like the Carrie Strug of impossible transitions. Just Google it. So every one of the battles that I am covering in this series has its own unique character, some quality that distinguishes it from other battles of World War I, and because this was the world's first modern global conflict, Those defining features were also sometimes historic firsts. The Somme, for example, was the first time tanks were ever used in war. I learned in researching this episode that the term tank was just an internal code name to keep Britain's rivals from discovering what they were working on, and the intended name of the vehicle was actually landship. So, not hard to imagine why tank stuck. And stuck they were. Of the 49 landships deployed at the Somme, 25 never actually moved. The 24 that did, however, offered both an enormous morale boost to the English, as well as a terrifying vision of the future to, like, fucking everybody else. No matter how heartening it must have been to have watched those industrial behemoths rolling over enemy trenches and barbed wire, which is what they were designed specifically to do, at some point the animal brain must have kicked in and said, hey, that monster? Yeah, it eats life. So, maybe don't trust it? This is a quote from one of the British infantry as he watched the Mark I's mobilize for the first time.
It was a funny sensation to see these tanks coming over the shell holes. No stopping. No matter what they came over. They got over it all right, and it was terrifying. It gave you a funny sensation to think that they were on our side. They were against us. It was a wonderful sensation, really, to see them, but it was horrifying. You know?
I know. I get that feeling of mortal terror anytime a shadow of a really big bird passes over my head. I mean, I know there is no bird big enough to swoop down and carry me off to be food for its babies, but at one point in our ancestral DNA, there was. And somewhere in my brain, that early mammalian is still rattling around. So, yes, dead English guy, I do indeed know. One of the other reasons the Somme is so well known to history is because of who fought in the battle. On the German side, both Otto Frank, future father of Anne Frank, and Adolf Hitler participated in the battle. Boy, there's a buddy movie with a third act that is definitely unwritable. And for the English, the man responsible for the lyrical content of at least 10 to 15% of all heavy metal albums, J.R.R. Tolkien, wrote his experiences of no man's land into the soil of Middle Earth. This is from the book The Two Towers.
Sam tripped. For a moment, the water below him looked like some window through which Sam peered.
There are dead things, dead faces in the water, dead faces,
he said with horror.
To which Gollum then replies,
There was a great battle long ago. The marshes have grown since then, swallowed up the graves. You cannot reach them, cannot touch them, all dead. And over on your left, you'll notice the world-famous Marne River, future site of Disneyland Paris.
Tolkien, man. What vision. But the real reason the Somme gets its own chapter in the history of World War I is because of one single day. The day that I mentioned on side A of this episode, July 1st, 1916, which was the single deadliest day in the history of the English army. And think about that. The single deadliest day for an army that was created as a standing military force in 1660. An army that fought in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War in the States. They fought in the War of American Independence in 1812, the Napoleonic Wars. And of course, World War II. And the single greatest loss of life came not from any of those, but from the First World War, which tells you what an exceptional event in human history this really was. But not in a good way. I hope that was clear. And here is why. The British general, Sir Douglas Haig, ordered the bombardment of German positions on the Somme with artillery fire for over a week. So the English knew that they could send their infantry through the small gaps available to them and take back those abandoned positions. In fact, as the orders were coming down, the English infantry were told that they wouldn't have to run or crawl through no man's land. They could just march, and I quote, like a parade. What they didn't know is that over half of the artillery shells from that week-long bombardment failed to detonate. So you had a mass of British soldiers literally walking into a tight space with German machine gunners sitting above them, both to the front and to either side. One of those German gunners later wrote,
When we started to fire, we just had to load and reload. They went down in the hundreds.
We didn't have to aim, we just fired into them. And then we had a bunch of free time on our hands, so about 70 years later, we created a bunch of weird techno music. Seemed like the right thing to do. After the loss of more than 19,000 men in a single day, General Haig made the absolutely brilliant strategic decision on July 2nd to do the exact same thing again. Because that's the last thing the Germans would expect him to do. I mean, not changing course would be so unfathomably stupid that it might actually have been a stroke of genius. It wasn't, but it might have been. So by November 18th, when the battle ended, both armies, as well as the French, had amassed a total of over 1 million casualties, to which Germany would contribute the largest share of 44,000. In the end, the Somme really could be considered a victory for the English. Again, it totally wasn't, but it could have been if it had produced a single solitary iota of strategic advantage for the Allies, which it did not. And in 2021, a Finnish band that took its name from the conflict released their second EP in as many years dedicated exclusively to World War I, titled Prussian Blood. It is also the final black metal offering that I will play for you on this series, and if it is to be the subgenre's black swan song, we ought to send them out as we know they would want us to, with terrible production values. This is Iron Kingdom by the band Somme. But I do take it upon myself to try to help them out a bit. Pump some bass in there, denoise that shit. Hey, just because they recorded it in their grandma's basement doesn't mean we have to listen to it there. The final battle that I want to talk about in any detail is another Douglas Haig joint, Passchendaele. The battle took its name from an individual hill on the landscape, much like Armageddon of Bible fame. There was a village on top of that hill that was also named Passchendaele, but after World War I, there was just a hill. And similar to Armageddon, Passchendaele felt to many of those who fought in the battle very much like the end of the world. Also known as the Third Battle of Ypres, Passchendaele took place on the North Atlantic coast and had been reclaimed from the sea by the nation of Belgium through a careful drainage and irrigation system developed over centuries. But the combination of heavy artillery shelling and a historically heavy downpour of rain for all but 3 days in August, the fields that once grew flax crops had been transformed into yawning craters filled with black, sucking mud. As one major in the field company of Royal Engineers wrote, there was no ground to walk on. The earth had been plowed up by shells not only once, but over and over again, so thoroughly that nothing solid remained to stand on. There was just loose, disintegrated, far-flung earth merging into slimy, treacherous mud and water around shell holes. He went on to describe the effect these conditions had on his fellow soldiers. Cowed and deadened by the monotony of extreme danger and the constant casualties among their mates, they hung on to existence by a thin thread of discipline rather than any spark of life. Some of the feebler and more highly strung deliberately ended their lives. The battle was made all the more terrible by the fact that it was launched almost entirely at the whim of one man, the aforementioned Sir Douglas Haig, who was told by the French Army Chief of Staff, as well as the fucking English Prime Minister, not to attack, as they could now wait for the American reserves to arrive and increase their chances of success by numbers. So he went and did it anyway, costing the armies another million casualties, fairly evenly divided between the French and English on the one side and the Germans on the other. Oh, and absolutely nothing was gained in the battle at all. The British Prime Minister that I mentioned just a minute ago was Lloyd George, who wrote in his memoirs in 1938, "Passchendaele was indeed one of the greatest disasters of the war. No soldier of any intelligence now defends this senseless campaign." And it should not surprise you to learn that none other than General Douglas Haig was indeed a soldier of no intelligence, as he seemed utterly convinced of his ultimate correctness in all things, including his signature strategy of sending as many of his own soldiers to their pointless deaths as he was able. And he was quite able. He was the mastermind behind the tactical genius of the human meat grinder in Verdun, the loss of over 57,000 men in a single day at the Somme, and the human soup we're all now wading through in Passchendaele. When I listened to the last episode, it was clear that I was growing increasingly unhinged the more I learned about the strategy of attrition, and was very much taking out that anger on Erich von Falkenhayn. But I realized that one person can't be considered responsible for the senseless cruelty of World War I. And now that I'm learning more and more about General Douglas Haig, I have to fight the impulse to fall back into that de facto soul rage. So, to take a page from the book of Sir Douglas Haig, I've decided to learn nothing from my own failings and just double down on my abject hatred of this colossally stupid mistake of a human being. For example, here is General Haig offering us a tiny window into his unequivocal capacities as a philosopher and visionary of the military sciences 8 years after the conclusion of World War I, gifting his wisdom unto us and the ages on the future of modern warfare as he sees it in 1926. "I believe that the value of the Hof and the opportunity for the Hof in the future are likely to be as great as ever. Aeroplanes and tanks are only accessories to the men and the Hof." I shit you not, this is 100% real. "And I feel sure that as time goes on, you will find just as much use for the Hof, the well-bred Hof, as you have ever done in the past." Well, so I take it all back. And just so that we don't lose track of what Haig's baffling incompetence actually cost the world, this is a Gold Star account from one of the soldiers who was forced to endure the ramifications of that incompetence and Haig's indefensible failures as a leader and a human being. This is Sergeant T. Berry from Passchendaele on October 11th, 1917. "We heard screaming coming from another crater a bit away. I went over to investigate with a couple of the lads. It was a big hole, and there was a fellow in it up to his shoulders. So I said, 'Go get your rifles, make a chain, and let's get a hold of him.' But it was too far to stretch. We couldn't get any force on it. And the more we pulled and the more he struggled, the further he seemed to go down. And he went down, gradually. He kept begging us to shoot him, but we couldn't shoot him. Who could shoot him? So we stayed with him, watching him go down in the mud. And he died like that. He wasn't the only one." Okay, so that's the last of those I'm going to read. No more black metal, no more bleak first-hand accounts from soldiers. We are now heading into the showbreak with a story of redemption. Specifically, my redemption. I have been, throughout this podcast, conspicuously lukewarm toward a certain band of legendary import to the history, philosophy, and future of heavy metal. And that band is Iron Maiden. Many of my friends and listeners have pointed out my transparently half-hearted attempts to convey the significance and the greatness of this band, that, with the exception of only Judas Priest, is undeniably the most influential act in the whole of traditional heavy metal. Black Sabbath is obviously not included here, as they are neither traditional heavy metal, nor are they constrained by the judgments of mortal men. I've always liked Iron Maiden. I have always appreciated Iron Maiden. I have played both Run to the Hills and The Trooper on this podcast, arguably two of the band's most well-known and widely beloved of their individual offerings, and both of which I like.
I like them. I wouldn't change the station if they came on the radio, if such a thing as radio still existed, but the truth is, I don't love them. I have listened to all of Iron Maiden's 80s output and a few songs off of Fear of the Dark from 1992, but nothing after Bruce Dickinson's departure from or return to the band, because if I don't love anything from their discography before that period, am I really gonna love anything after? And then the time arrived in which I needed to find a song that could be related to the Battle of Passchendaele. 1914 has a song called Passion Hell, but I've already played them. Tides of Sulfur has an EP called Ypres that covers the battle, but I've played them as well. The band God Dethroned also has an album called Passchendaele, which isn't terrible, but they spell it P-A-S-S-I-O-N Dale, which is terrible, so I'm not playing it. Which meant that I was left to rely somewhat reluctantly on the song Passchendaele from Iron Maiden's 13th studio album, Dance of Death, in 2003. Now, in my imagination, listening to an Iron Maiden track off of an album I've never heard from the year 2003 that has some of the worst cover art that I've ever seen in my life sounded like something Donald Rumsfeld might personally approve to be played on a 24-hour loop at ear-splitting decibels should I ever be held as an enemy combatant in Guantanamo Bay. But as I'm sure you've guessed at this point, I fucking loved it. I absolutely, unequivocally loved the song Passchendaele by Iron Maiden. It's 8 minutes and 28 seconds long, and I'm gonna play the whole fucking thing for you right now. And when we come back, we are gonna close out our series on World War I with the Russian Revolution and the events leading up to the Armistice of 1918. But I shall return in the same fashion that Bruce Dickinson does absolutely everything in life shortly. Oh, come on, you knew I was going to get one in there, right? Just because I have a favorite Iron Maiden song now, that doesn't mean I'm not the same old Quinn that you've come to know and then eventually know a little better. Whatever, we'll sort this out after Passchendaele. My favorite song by Iron Maiden. When we come back.
In a foreign field he lay, lonely soldier, unknown grave. On his dying words he prays, tell the world of Passchendaele. We live all that he's been through, last communion of his soul. Rust your bullets with his tears, let me tell you about his years. Shouts and more gunfire.